This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. How did we link motherhood and apple pie? Why do we clothe babies in pink or blue? How did we come to the term metrosexual? On the program this afternoon, we're going to explore our ideas about gender, past and present. Our guest is historian Mary Ryan. Her latest book is Mysteries of Sex, Tracing Women and Men Through American History. Think of all the changes we've seen over the last few decades. Mary Ryan sees our recent history as turbulent. In the introduction to her book, she says 40 years ago, housewife was still the modal occupation for the female sex. The learned professors of law and medicine were virtually male preserves, and the notion of gay marriage was unimaginable. But, you know, when it comes to gender, this is my thought now, our recent history is not the only turbulent period we've seen. There have been plenty of times where we've seen turbulence in this country over gender. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Mary Ryan. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Mary Ryan is a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of six books and many articles on the history of the United States. Her latest book, Mysteries of Sex, Tracing Women and Men Through American History, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Ryan, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Happy to be here.
Would you explain the significance of your title, Mysteries of Sex?
Well, first, I guess I have to issue a warning. It is not intended to be titillating. It's not a mystery of sex. It doesn't mean it's a sort of Law and Order Special Victims Unit presentation. But it really is. I did think about that title and said I had to dare, being misrepresenting things a little bit by making it sound more sensational. But it really is the most accurate way of phrasing what the book is about. I want, first of all, to convey a sense of mystery about the difference between men and women, the men and women that I'm tracing through American history. I want to encourage people to think not of, you know, men and women in two boxes or two little tracks through history, but to consider the whole historical process which differentiates men from women. So, and that differentiation is based bluntly on sex. It's maybe somewhat arbitrary readings of sexual differences, but it's based on the bodies, the reproductive systems, the sexuality of the human species. You know? So I'm tracking that process of differentiation, and I think it's a mysterious one. It's something that we should question, not assume, but ask about. Hmm. So sex and mystery are terms that reflect the theme of the book, the history that I recount through seven chapters, but it also reflects a little bit of my attitude towards that subject matter. I've been studying it for something like 35 years now, and it's been as intriguing as a detective story. Mm. You can imagine how interesting it is, a sort of experience that I'll probably not replicate in my career, to be able to address a subject that 30 years ago, 35 years ago, was really not there, had not been identified. So a whole world of historical questions about, you know, seeing men as the history of women was opened up to me. So tracing that history, discovering it, has been intriguing, and it's been a series of intellectual problems that are, as, you know, as exciting as a detective story.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever solve the mysteries of sex?
Well, we might solve one or another, and then another one will appear in its place, I would think. I mean, I guess that's part of it too. I think there is, you know, sexuality is or sex difference, male and female, is one of the many, many varieties and intricacies of humans, and they will keep surprising us.
Yeah.
My concern, of course, is that in the past, that difference has led to inequality. It's led to, you know, arbitrary assignments of what people should do and how they should behave and how they should think. There's lots of, you might say, there's some crimes, you know, behind this detective story as well.
Yeah.
So I take a sort of, you know, look optimistically to the future, but see a lot of troubles in the history of sexuality, of sex difference as well.
Yeah. You know, you say in the introduction that the most momentous mystery of sex is whether gender differences can wither away or at least be reduced in significance and disarmed of inequity and oppression. Where are we today?
Well, I think we're at a moment of consolidating extraordinary changes that have occurred in the last, you know, half century or so. There are many ways in which both the rigidity and the what I call the sting of sex difference is being reduced. Perhaps a way to explain that is to work off some of the concepts that I use in the book as a way of sort of sorting out the different meanings that are attributed to being male and female historically. One is just the level of asymmetry, just our... If you put men and women alongside one another, do they look different? Are they doing different things? Are they are different temperaments attributed to them? And on that score, my first sort of axis of gender difference, we're getting more symmetrical from the constitution of the labor force, where women are close to 50% of the labor force now, to the, you know, the aspirations of college students, to the number of men and women in college. All those things are leveling off to a remarkable extent. The next axis of gender that I talk about is the relations between the sexes, which, you know, through most of American history, and certainly if we go back to 1950, the vast majority of adult men and women were married and resided in households with their children. We learn in this, you know, the 2005 census, that for the first time, the majority of adult women are not living with husbands.
Mm-hmm.
So sexes are, you know, they're relating in different ways. We have possibilities of homosexual marriages, and we have the fact that simply living in a nuclear household is no longer the dominant experience. Most households, for the first time, also in 2005, do not have at their center a husband and wife.
Yeah.
So the relations of the sexes have changed tremendously. And then the big question, of course, is: Are we getting more equal? Are we equal yet? And again, the last 40 years have shown remarkable change. I remember in the early days of feminism, people wore little buttons that said 59 cents to show the differential between male and female
mm-hmm.
income. Women made 59 cents for men who made a dollar. That's been slowly moving upward to, you know, something like 75 cents, which may look small. It still looks like inequality. But in fact, that ratio had been stable for a century. So there's a moment of transformation in the late 20th century.
Yeah.
Because it's short of equality,
right.
Short of uniformity.
Yeah.
I think it's been, it's had wonderful and optimistic sides to it. History shows that change doesn't necessarily mean transformation and utopia. So I will be alert, as we all should be, to what's left to be done to change these relationships for the better.
One of the buttons I remember from my girlhood was a woman's place is in the House and Senate.
Right.
And it seems to me that we've we have moved away from a kind of that 1950s rigidity to a place of some elasticity. So I don't know if you want to comment on that. I also have a caller we can wait to hear. Would you like to make a comment on my observation?
Well, that's it's a very nice term for it, elasticity. And that's, I mean, an extremely optimistic one, too. I mean, we don't want to reverse roles or create a new standard. But for me, greater freedom and possibility is what hopefully has occurred. How much further it'll go is a question not for a historian.
Mm. We are talking with a historian this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her name is Mary Ryan, and her latest book is Mysteries of Sex, Tracing Women and Men Through American History. You can join the conversation this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I had a couple of different things I was hoping that your guest could address. The first is the issue of men swearing in front of women, because as I was growing up, I know my father swore, but he would absolutely never swear in front of the family, or even in front of my mother, and I think that's a generational thing, because men of my generation don't seem to have any problem at all with swearing in front of women. I'm 34, and the other one is I heard a story on NPR a few weeks ago where they were interviewing some elderly men who had worked on fish boats in their youth, and apparently they had some pretty raunchy songs that they would sing when they were out on these boats. And the person doing the interview was a woman, and they wouldn't sing most of the songs to her, or they adapted them because they just didn't feel it was appropriate to sing them in front of a lady. And I guess my initial feeling about those kinds of things is that women were seen as being too innocent or something like that. They didn't want to be, sorry about the baby, they didn't want to offend the women. But then I got to thinking, well, maybe it was sort of a negotiation where they knew if they sang these songs in front of women that they wouldn't have a chance with the women. So I guess I'll go ahead and hang up offline so people don't have to listen to my own little nuclear family units.
Babies' cries are most welcome.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question that you pose, and for, you know, a detective of the mysteries of sex, it raises sort of the complications of this question. On the one hand is your first example, the fact that men are no longer reluctant to use colorful language in front of women. Suggest, is that just a change in history in general, that in fact we all swear more, regardless of gender, or is it really a case of changing differences between men and women? And I think you're perhaps onto something quite basic there, that, you know, another historian would perhaps like to trace the ways in which there is a kind of real increasing, to use Celeste Worm's words, elasticity in relations of sexes, that you can now relax that boundary which says that a woman is pure and fragile and should not be exposed to the gruffness of men. Your other question, your other example, also poses interesting historical issues, because that fishing boat would be an example of what historians would be call a place of male culture, of homosocial bonding, of where men establish their own cultures and traditions and rough habits of dealing with one another. The question is, as men and women mix more socially and in workplaces, will those kind of distinctive cultures, whether they be a masculine world of roughness or a woman's world of tea parties, be dissolving? And what are the consequences of that? There are no doubt comforts and pleasures that have existed in separate worlds of men and women. And to totally eradicate them, to make male or female friendship groups disappear is not necessarily a hopeful possibility. But the question is how, like other aspects of the differences of sex, can they be accommodated in ways that give more freedom and more equality and more choice to both sexes, to the men and to the women.
Yeah. Here we might think about gender and what it is. You quote the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu as saying, gender is something we do. A couple of questions here, and I think this goes back to, also we maybe can talk about where we do it.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do gender, and why do we do gender?
Well, perhaps one way I can respond to that, I think that's a wonderful notion from Bourdieu, and there are several women sociologists that have used that same sort of concept of doing gender. It's not something you are, it's something that you practice. It's not something that's just written in the books or told to you by television. It's something that you create in your own everyday habits. And the way I explain this to my students is I show them a slide that it's reproduced in the book, Mysteries of Sex. It's a picture of the symbol that I found at the Yerba Buena Center in San Francisco, a trendy art gallery. And it's the signs for the restrooms are these extremely abstract references, possibly, to male costume as opposed to female costume. So for on the one hand, you have one shape that seems to vaguely, if you know the reference point, and if you're looking for a restaurant, looks like a skirt, and the other one maybe looks like pants. But it would be totally unintelligible to most people. But the point is, so there it is, gender differences between male and female is sort of abstract, hard to read in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, we all read them. We take those signs, we process them, and then we act on them. And every day, every one of us follows in our behavior those signs. We go to a men's room and to a woman's room, and we never, never question them. So that's kind of the process of doing it, of making it, which we can compound, by every minute of every day and every life of every person. And we should also compound it not just in terms of our everyday life, but in historical time. For the 500 years of history that I go back in this book, people have always been using that sign of male and female to give directions to their everyday life. To an Indian woman in pre-Columbian times would go and plant the corn. A male would go and hunt and be a warrior. Those signs are perhaps, less dichotomous. Our paths are less different from one another than they were 500 years ago. But we continue to do that. What history can do and what I try to do in my book is to say as much as how we're always using that sign of difference between male and female, we can change the direction of those signs. And, in fact, the meaning of them, where they tell men and women to go, has changed repeatedly over the last 500 years. So that's what the 7 chapters of my book describe that process.
Yeah. Are there points, are there moments in history where we're likely to say we're not going to participate anymore in the way we've been doing, to keep with that verb, gender, that what we want, what we need is a change? If you think of the enfranchisement of women in the United States in 1920, you think of the abolition movement of the 19th century, the civil rights movement and the women's movement of the latter half of the 20th century. What leads to these moments, this kind of time in these points in history where we sit down?
Well, There are lots of ways. The one you mentioned is the first one you mentioned, the contemporary changes of the women's movement, and which we date from the 1960s, is sort of the classic one, and I'd probably like to talk for that a minute. But let me just lay out the way, varieties of ways that it can change. Sometimes it can be sudden and cataclysmic. I think of that, for example, where I start the book, and you know, with the arrival of Europeans on the North American continent. At that point, there's a sudden and immediate conflict between two different ways of defining male and female, and it would take, you know, would not be, it would be a sudden confrontation, and within a 200-year period, a European way of defining male and female eclipsed that of American Indians. Other times, it's a very slow process. I think the creating of a Victorian gender system, which I talk about in another chapter, probably took, you know, a long 200-year process. We've talked about the rapid changes that occurred since the 1960s in this particular country. And there we can see a change that seems to operate through, as you described it, sitting down as a real, you know, political resistance, which can be more, we can date. Historians have found times and places where the first challenge to the meaning of gender occurred. But if we look even at those events, we would find, you know, a sort of long process leading up to a moment of rupture. For example, I would say that the changes, that the whole 20th century was a period of progressive transformation in gender that maybe took three generations. For example, the last generation of women that did not return to the labor force after marriage was born in 1895. And we had one generation entering the labor force, say, in the 19-teens and 20s, as young women retiring to bear their children, and they would often come back into the labor force, even in, for example, in World War II, when they were called to munitions factories and to fulfill roles as men were absent in the fighting forces. The next generation of the 1950s, their daughters, for example, might have gone, you know, enthusiastically home and into the suburban femininity that Betty Friedan called a feminine mystique. But by the time they were in their mid-30s, they were back in the labor force. That would bring us to a generation that's, you know, that is on the scene making decisions and life choices about how they're going to follow the signs of sex in the 1960s. And interestingly enough, as I see it, those first expressions of a new feminism were sustained by whole generations of women that were making changes and seeing that those changes were not sufficient. They were discovering the inequality of sex. So, for example, in the 1960s, those women who returned to the labor force after they born their children and raised their families would discover that they were getting unequal treatment. They were in a world now where they could compete with men, and they were getting unequal paychecks. In 1960, the typical college graduate woman was making what a high school-educated man was. Very quickly, and registered in the Civil Rights Acts of 1964, equal pay for equal work will become an issue, because women have changed and they've discovered inequality. The daughters of that generation, the ones that were going to college, not back into the labor force in the 1960s, would see the same thing. For the first time in the 1960s, we start getting equal college education between men and women, that the colleges are composed equally of men and women, where a generation before women would be only a third of the students. They're there in the same place, They're doing the same jobs, they're getting A's, and they see that they're not getting the same career prospects and equal treatment. There are other stories about this sort of moment that I call the feminist dialectic, that moment when you have confidence, you make steps forward, be it in college or the labor force or maybe in the Peace Corps. You see that new empowerment, and at the same time you're sort of slapped in the face that you don't get to go the next step and you don't get properly rewarded for it. Those are moments when change can have this, you know, explosive feel to it. But, of course, it's built on a long process that may be generations in depth, might be building on your grandmother's and building on your own accumulated life experience, but it'll come together in a moment and be explosive and transform minds, you know, as well as behaviors.
Let's take a couple more calls. Let's talk next with a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. At what point in history did the modern difference in male and female dress take place? In other words, when did women start wearing skirts and men start wearing pants?
Well, believe it or not, I'm not an expert on fashion, but I can take a stab at your question.
Okay.
Well, first of all, you can ask it in terms of, with like all these gendered questions, you can ask it in terms of time of age in life as well as historical time. So, for example, old books on the history of childhood point out that in the past, you know, up until age 6 or 7, both boys and girls wore dresses in the West, in Europe, and in America. So that's been a slow process. We can go up to the 18th century when certain sort of courtly fashions appear. And at that point, yes.
Have we lost the guest?
No, I'm here.
The caller is still here, but...
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry.
We heard a clunk there, and I thought we lost somebody or both parties, so...
Okay. Well, I got back right on.
Okay.
So here I am again.
Good.
And let me continue. In the 18th century, you can see, you know, men, male and female dress for the upper classes extremely differentiated. But they'll be differentiated in terms of gender, but not in degree of ornamentation. What I mean is men are wearing pants and women are wearing voluminous skirts in these courtly paintings and etchings. But men are, you know, dolled up as much or more than women and with as much or more, you know, sort of sexual attention to it. They'll be wearing very tight silk pants and high stockings. At that same time, perhaps poorer men and women would, both men and women, wearing loose skirt-like garments. For example, one name for, during the French Revolution, one name for the popular classes, the more rebellious classes, were the sans-culottes, without skirts, because they wore more open clothes. But if you want to think in terms of the three-piece suit and as opposed to the hourglass figure, that in the United States is very clear on the streets of New York in photographs by the 1850s. So I would hypothesize that maybe there's kind of an arc of change in terms of that stark differentiation of skirt versus suit being there in the 1850s, and of course unisex in the 1960s, may the other end of the arc marking another transformation. But I must say, I would advise you to go to your library and pick up one of those many books on the history of fashion that'll tell that story more thoroughly than I have.
I remember sometime in the 30s, I'm over 80, the current Pope Pius, issued a papal bull on this, and he said there's something psychologically wrong with a woman who wears pants. A woman who desires to dress like a man.
Huh.
And
well, the Pope is wearing a skirt-like garment, isn't he? Yeah. I wonder what we would say about that.
I don't know. You know, going back to those restroom signs, you know, if they have to be, for me to work, they have to be side by side. Otherwise, I'm confused because if I see the sign that is meant to designate the men's room, the body there, there's a circle at the top, you know, which represents the head, and then the body is a triangle.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, well, that kind of, that, you know, I, that, 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 I could go in there. And it wouldn't be until I see this other sign next to it, which clearly is someone whose leg is showing, even though the leg is a triangle. It doesn't work.
Yeah. Oh, maybe we read it wrong. Maybe I read it wrong.
You know, they have to be side by side. I don't know. The triangle on the sign that it denotes the men's room, you know, I could take that point of the triangle as the bust line.
You're right.
So
it is. You know, I've been noticing this. There's also a restaurant in Baltimore where I live that has signs of peacocks on the door, which is, you know, guaranteed to, you know, cause confusion because the male peacock, of course, is the most dramatic.
Yeah, so bright.
And I've noticed it in other places where, you know, trendy restaurants that want to be real cool in the way they mark their restrooms, you can't really tell. It's worth, I think, a book by or an article by somebody, a piece of photojournalism, don't you think?
Yeah.
The
well,
changing designations of restaurants.
It also tells us how much we count on that kind of practical information, and we don't stop to think about it.
Right. That's the point I want to make.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller, listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
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 I think from a couple of, actually 3 points, and quick. I think it's wonderful today that I have a daughter, and in terms of the options today, you're talking about work and or whether stay-at-home mom. I mean, they have the options today, and which is great. And the I don't know in all families, but I have a great son-in-law, and you know, she could go back to work or in terms of the children or whatever. And I think it's absolutely wonderful. She's taken the option to be a stay-at-home mom for a while, and I have a four-year-old granddaughter, and just recently another granddaughter who's about 3 months old. But I think this is great. I'm also, I mentioned as being in the program that, you know, this gender differences were the males are in the program in terms of helping to raise the child or children. I think this is a wonderful thing and something I don't think is whether it's a trend or whatever, but when I look around at some of the other people I know, you know, these younger people, that they're also in the program in terms of the children, really in it, you know, and excited about it and doing something with it. And then the last one, I do work with a college student from time to time, and in terms of the young ladies, I don't think they sometimes hesitate in terms of swearing. But anyway, if you want any comments, fine. If not, that's my comment.
You raise a really couple of really, you know, important points. One is that clearly gender change is for, I think, and the gender changes in recent history are very much for the benefit of men as well as women, though it seems to me that in those course of the changes in the 20th century, women have been making most of them. They're the ones that have gone off to work. They're the ones that are wearing pants. Men are neither, you know, wearing skirts, or they're doing more in housework. They're doing a little bit more in childcare, and that's great, but it's not nearly equal. And what also really fascinates me is the degree to which men have not rebelled against the onerous aspects of their own gender assignments, which are manifest, you know, most painfully as we look at the photographs of who is dying in Iraq today. That it seems to me there's an unequal, there's a, you know, wrong side of the bargain for men who have less involvement in the wonderful joys of raising children and more obligations to serve in the American military. So, and the other point that we haven't discussed very much is the degree to which these degrees of choice and freedom are very much differentiated by your status, your class, your resources. You know, we had a Welfare Rights Act in 1966, which required that that women, disadvantaged women with unequal resources, are required to go into the labor force rather than be on public assistance. At the same time, we have lots of stories in the popular press these days about terribly advantaged Ivy League women making choices to go home with their expensive degrees in their pockets. So there's great variation in terms of your economic resources, which are often also correlated with your race in this country, that make this all these changes unequal and uneven.
Mm. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Before we run out of time, well, let's take another call. We've got another call that's just come in, and I want to, before I launch into another question and we have another answer, let's take the call. Listener in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm sorry. I've just gotten in on about the last 10 minutes, but my mind went to the news item about the young teenage girls that were bullying one another in Rhode Island. And I know last night on Larry King or the other night, they had a couple people that were talking about it, seeming to be some kind of trend about this kind of horrible activity happening at that age group. Would you have any comment on that?
I'm sorry, I don't know the situation. I didn't watch Larry King, and I don't
know
the
incident.
Well,
it appeared on the Internet. It was on the national news, too, about three young women that were bullying and hit one another in a brawl. Maybe it was something more of it was made out of nothing, but it seems there has been, in the recent past, at least according to certain news reports, more bullying going on among young girls than ever before. I guess that would be in that area.
Yeah. Well, just my comments are, number one, bullying wouldn't be a cause of comment if it was happening to men. So does this show that the gender differentiations on the category of bullying have become less extreme? Is that the sign of it, or is it just the same old tendency to read events through a lens and an eye of gender, that in fact probably incidents of this kind of behavior, are pretty randomly distributed through the populations, but when it happens to women, it's going to get particular attention. I don't really know, but that's one of the cases in which I think we should see this, as I suggest, I assume your question assumes that this is, it's a mystery, something that we have to explain. We just can't assume that men bully and women by nature don't.
Hmm. What I wanted to talk with you about before we run out of time is gender in the public square. You address this topic throughout the book, really, I think, in all kinds of ways, and then quite... then you take it on full steam ahead in the chapter, What is the Sex of Citizenship?
Right.
And this is very interesting to me. When did we in the United States begin to see women as citizens? Because in the early days of the Republic, women were not seen as citizens. They didn't have the vote. They couldn't hold property. They couldn't serve on juries. And they were heralded not as citizens, but as Republican helpmates. What an interesting place to maybe here to wrap up. We can talk about the segregated public square and how it has changed, how it is changing.
Yeah, this is it's a terribly important element of the story, and I think it sort of illustrates what I was trying to do in the book. That's a long central chapter,
mm-hmm.
Because I think what happens in politics and in public life is key to the meanings of male and female. So I ask the question, what is the sex of citizenship? And I suppose the standard assumption, an answer to that, would have been on the part of historians, well, up until a particular moment, citizenship was male.
Mm-hmm.
The public sphere was a male domain. And then in 1920, women get the vote, we get full citizenship, and now, citizenship is no longer gendered. I think the story is more complicated than that. First, it starts out with the creation of the citizen. At what point do members of the polity and of the nation, are they invested with rights and obligations? And, of course, that's the story of the creation of American democracy in the 18th century and the building of democratic institutions and the expansion of the franchise in the early 19th century. And that whole process is really showing that citizenship in America, the American nation, is founded on a gendered sense of who the citizen is. It is male, and it is all males. You can say, in an earlier period, the citizen, the person who could act for the community in general, say in a New England town meeting even, was not just a male, but a head of household who owned property. In America, the early 19th century, citizenship is made expressly masculine by saying, regardless of how much property you have, even in the case of if you're black, you'll probably be denied that citizenship. But immigrant males will be granted the vote immediately. So it's expressly based on your gender, citizenship at that point. Not only is it based on your gender, but it's sort of practiced in masculine ways. It's by being a soldier. That's a mark of citizenship. By being a member of a party that met in smoke filled rooms and march through the streets in torchlight processions and maybe fought it out at the polling place. It's a very rowdy, masculine notion of citizenship and rights and in terms of practice. So you might say then, so women are just shunned aside in this. Lots of work by historians of women have shown that, in fact, that's not exactly what happens, that at the same time that part of the public sphere, the official voting public, is being occupied by men who behave in masculine ways, women are building what I call a whole public domain of their own, that they are meeting perhaps in churches and sewing circles rather than in taverns and polling places. They are assuming the function, maybe not of policing, but the function of charitable work and providing for the public welfare. They are building up ideas about, the proper behavior. They're even, in some cases, policing sexuality by petitioning legislatures to create seduction laws. All this is happening in the early 19th century. And by the time we get to the late 19th century, women have built a huge public sphere. You could see it in everything from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, mm-hmm. with millions of members, to the settlement houses in the cities that are pioneering all sorts of new ideas and new institutions for progressive reform of municipalities that is giving women perhaps more stature than at any time, more political stature than any time in our history. And they've done it without the vote because they have built a separate public space.
And on the foundation of that, they march,
yes.
right?
Right. They do. It's a big moment when women dare in the first decade of the 20th century to dress up and parade through the streets. The men have been doing that for a century, and this is a major moment.
Yeah. There we have to leave it because, unfortunately, we're out of time. But let me tell listeners, Mary Ryan, that I think that we'd all benefit by thinking about these issues. And I want to let listeners know, I want to just mention a couple of the titles of your chapters. Who baked that apple pie and when? And how domesticity conquered American culture. That's chapter two. And chapter three, which follows, is another very fascinating chapter. How did race get color, gender and sexuality in the American South? And then, as we mentioned here at the end, what is the sex of citizenship? That is chapter four of the book. So many interesting topics and ideas that are presented here in Mary Ryan's book, Mysteries of Sex, Tracing Women and Men Through American History. Professor Ryan, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mysteries of Sex, Tracing Women and Men Through American History is published by the University of North Carolina Press.